Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, queer radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. This week, we look at preserving queer culture in San Francisco's Castro District and throughout the city at affordable housing and COVID. And I imagine how those three things affect each other with San Francisco Supervisor Rafael Mandelman. You may know that Rafael Mandelman is currently the only LGBTQ member of San Francisco's Board of Supervisors. He represents District 8, which includes the Castro, Glen Park, Noe Valley, Diamond Heights, and Mission Dolores. He grew up in San Francisco and returned to the city after studying history, affordable housing, and community development at Yale, receiving a master's degree in public policy from Harvard and a law degree from UC Berkeley. Before becoming supervisor, he was an Oakland deputy city attorney working on redevelopment, real estate, and affordable housing, and was president of San Francisco City College's Board of Trustees during a very rough patch. He was widely recognized as steering the 80-year institution through its recent accreditation crisis. Mandelman has been active on numerous public and nonprofit boards, including his service as co-chair of the San Francisco LGBT Centers Board. As San Francisco supervisor, he serves on numerous committees. He's vice chair of the Rules Committee and chair of the San Francisco County Transportation Authority and represents San Francisco at ABAG, the Association of Bay Area Governments. Mandelman served on San Francisco's COVID-19 Economic Recovery Task Force. I'm sure we'll talk about recovery from COVID in this half hour. Rafael Mandelman, welcome to Out in the Bay.
It's great to be here. Good morning.
So let's start with your backstory. A lot of your work has centered on helping people who are experiencing homelessness and mental health issues, two subjects that you personally know about. Please tell us a little bit more about your background.
I moved to San Francisco in the 80s when my mother was no longer able to take care of me. I was an 11-year-old kid. My grandmother was in San Francisco, and my mom was sort of spiraling into mental illness. And she struggled with that for the remainder of her life, for about 30-something more years. During that period, she lived, she lived in institutions, board and cares, and she was actually in a homeless shelter for a period of time as well. So, my interest in mental health and in the connection between mental health and homelessness kind of goes back to my own, family and in particular, my mother.
Where did your mom live?
She was in Southern California. She was in Orange County.
You grew up in San Francisco after the age of 11. It's a longtime gay-friendly town. How old were you when you came out, and how do you think the experience compared to your peers from other places?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I grew up in this very gay-friendly place, but I had to leave San Francisco to come out. I remember having out teachers, but even, San Francisco in the late 80s, early 90s, if you were growing up here, you were insulated, I think, a little bit, or a lot of us were, from like this amazing, like, queer mecca thing that's going on the other side of Twin Peaks. I was out in the Sunset, and I was aware of gay people. I knew they existed, but I wasn't, I wasn't comfortable with my own identity. I was certainly teased and by kids in high school who, I think knew better than I, where I was going.
Funny how that is.
Yeah. So it took me a little while. I had to go off to Yale, which is a very gay college. And gradually, I came out there by my sophomore year. But yeah, it took me a little while. Like, I'm a late bloomer here. Kids today, they're coming out in seventh grade. They're telling everybody,
Yeah, that's true. But it's still not easy for everyone. There's we grew up with straight parents. I grew up in Berkeley. And when I first came out, I had people say, I don't understand. You didn't come out till I didn't come out till I was 33. I was married briefly.
Uh-huh.
And, my gay friends said, I don't understand. You grew up here in the Bay Area. How could you? Well, yeah, but, I was still raised by straight parents in a mostly heterocentric society. So there you go.
I think it's even when, we achieve full legal equality, we're getting closer, thank God. But I think it's always every queer person who has to, figure out that they are queer, that they are somehow different, whether, in terms of their gender identity or their sexual orientation or what it's going to I think that's going to continue to be a thing, and hopefully a far less painful thing than it has been in the past. But those folks who have to figure out that they're different from their peers in this way are always going to have that moment or that time. So I think it actually makes us great. I think that's part of the special amazingness of being queer.
Very good. So briefly, what was so gay about Yale? I didn't know that it had that reputation.
Oh, Yale definitely. Yale was the gay Ivy, or at least when I was there. And it was, it had gay professors. Boswell, who did the work on same-sex marriage in pre-modern Europe, was a professor there and was known. And there were the Yale co-op dances, which were sort of known in New York. And at one point, I think the Wall Street Journal, this was before I was there, but did a story on how many homosexuals there were at Yale, and came to the conclusion that 1 in 4 Yale students was gay or lesbian. So that sort of sparked this kind of motto of 1 in 4, maybe more, that was in vogue when I was there. So there was a lot of queer activity at Yale when I was there in the 90s.
I love that expression, 1 in 4, maybe more.
Yeah.
How did you decide to study affordable housing and community development and public policy?
At Yale, I was a history major, and I was really into the Greeks and humanities and all that stuff. But I was also interested in what was going on in New Haven. And New Haven had this sort of unique identity as one of the poorest cities in the country and one of the richest states. It was very much emblematic of that northeastern phenomena of the once industrial towns and cities that had been kind of left behind. So I got I had to work through college because I was a financial aid kid. And the great job that I got for a summer and then was able to keep during term time was working in New Haven's Office of Housing and Community Development. And I, got to go out and see the New Haven that Yale students didn't see and learn about, kind of urban problems and how, a medium-sized city like New Haven tries to like address the out migration of affluent people, the urban challenges of the people who remain, the housing projects, all the stuff that is still with us, but was certainly in the 90s in these sort of post-industrial towns kind of a challenge. So it was an interesting introduction, and then I went on to law school where I focused on kind of local government and policy school where I focused on housing, urban economic development, and transportation.
So what eventually got you into politics?
I always thought that politics and government was the most interesting thing. I remember being in kindergarten or first grade when the 1980 presidential election was happening. And they had those weekly reader polls of the kids and who they were voting for. And of course, most kids, I'm sure, like, had no particular ideas. But I knew I was supporting John Anderson, and I had a theory about why that was as a 5 or 6 year old. I just continued to be fascinated by politics. Even in middle school, I was trying to plan my own political party. As soon as I got out, even I think while I was in law school, I started getting involved in the Democratic clubs in San Francisco. And San Francisco has tons of Democratic clubs for every identity group, type of person. I got involved in the queer Democratic clubs, the Alice B. Toklas Club and the Harvey Milk Club and the Noe Valley Democratic Club, because I was living in Noe at the time. Got myself involved in some campaigns, served on some city commissions. And eventually ran for the Democratic County Central Committee, which is a thing people can run for, eventually ran for the Board of Supervisors in 2010 against Scott Wiener, who beat me. But what I've been saying is, if you're going to run and lose to someone who's actually a very good politician, Scott is, I don't agree with him on everything, but he is kind of the model of the man never sleeps, works all the time. Very disciplined, and I learned a lot from running against him.
Yeah, I bet. He definitely has that reputation for getting into the details. Yeah. So let's move on to your role right now as a supervisor. What do you see as the most pressing issues facing the Castro and District 8, and for that matter, the whole city?
Well, of course, in the immediate term, it is the pandemic and the economic impacts of the pandemic. We've been very successful, I think, in some ways in San Francisco in keeping our cases down and keeping our deaths down. And we should all be proud of that. But the cost to our to our communities and our particularly our small businesses has been huge. We've lost a lot of people. There's some estimates that as many as 100,000 people have left the Bay Area, have left San Francisco rather, over the last year.
You mean residents, 100,000 residents. That's a lot. Wow.
It is. And I know because I see just sort of business after business announcing that they're closing permanently. And I think that's going to continue, you know, even just, you know, we now have a light at the end of the tunnel, maybe in terms of the vaccinations, but people, you know, it's not just going to be a light switch where things come back and everything's back to normal. You know, the concerns about what happens when the commercial eviction moratoriums go away and these businesses that are way behind on their rent have to figure that out or leave their space. So I think we have a fair amount of pain in our future as well as our past. So that is, I think, the immediate challenge. And then I think there's all the challenges that San Francisco has been struggling with for a while, homelessness and particularly, you know, folks with significant substance abuse and or behavioral health issues, not having a place to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a big one. It has been for a long time.
Yep.
How are you working to address these issues?
Oh my gosh.
Well, I mean, were there any key initiatives that you're working on right now? For example, there's this thing, the 1939 Market Street Plan. What is it and where is it and what's the plan there?
Well, 1939 Market is a property on Market Street just up from where the LGBT Center is. It has been a real priority of mine from the time I was elected to get more affordable housing preserved and produced in the district that I represent. District 8, which includes the Castro and Noe Valley, Glen Park, has had some of the highest rates of displacement, gentrification and displacement of evictions in the city. It's right behind District 9, which includes the Mission, by some of those measures. But it's had a relatively low rate of production of new affordable housing. And so in my conversations with the mayor, as we talked about what my priorities were for the district, getting some sites where we could do significant affordable housing projects was, you know, what I identified as something I'd like to work with her on. And sure enough, she and her Office of Housing and Community Development were able to find the site on the market. It is literally around the corner from two LGBT senior housing developments, 55 Laguna and 95 Laguna, that are a collaboration between Open House, which is an LGBT senior housing provider, and Mercy Housing, which is a very a rather large affordable housing developer. And so my hope has been that we can, there is now a request for qualifications out in the field to find a developer or development team that may be able to do something to add to that stock of LGBT-friendly senior housing. And I think we're developing actually quite a nice queer neighborhood there with the queer senior housing, the LGBT center down the road. And then actually the Gay Men's Chorus building is also just a hop, skip, and a jump away. So you know, the Castro is just up the street. Or arguably, this is part of the Castro, but it's, you know, we're getting a little concentration of queer nonprofits around there that I think is exciting. Not to mention, you know, getting another, if we could get another 100 units of queer senior housing for low income seniors, a portion of whom are homeless, actually coming in the other buildings, and I would imagine we'll do that here too.
You're hearing Out in the Bay, Queer Radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen, speaking with Raphael Mandelman, San Francisco supervisor representing District 8, which includes the Castro District. So the Castro was, in the past, affectionately called by some the center of the gay universe. And, you know,
still is.
Okay, great. It still is. And that's good to know. And yet people do sort of worry about the character being diluted, let's just say. Mm-hmm. So what is being done to preserve its queer character?
Yes. Well, the decline of the gayborhoods is not just a San Francisco phenomena. It is a national phenomena, and I think has been concerning to me and lots of other folks. I remember when the West Village in New York felt very, very gay, and it doesn't anymore. And it isn't the center of queer life in New York. Thankfully, I think the Castro still is a center of queer life in San Francisco, but it is not as queer of a place as maybe it was 20 or 30 years ago. There's been a lot of folks thinking about and working on how to make it still a place where queer people can come and concentrate and feel comfortable. I do think we need those geographic spaces to meet, particularly for folks who are coming out. You know, I know we have this virtual world building and the apps and all sorts of ways for people to connect, but I'm still a fan of, like, particularly as a year into the pandemic, I'm a fan of places where people can actually meet, and particularly for queer people to be able to actually meet. So there have been some very cool initiatives in that regard. I mean, there are the folks who are working on the plaques that are going in throughout the Castro celebrating LGBTQ history, the Rainbow Honor Walk. There is now an LGBTQ cultural district that has recently formed, and they now have a full board, and they're looking at ways to promote queer arts and culture, and maybe build a Castro that is more open and affirming for people who may not have always felt so welcome in the Castro, people of color, gender non-binary people, trans people. The Castro, I love the Castro. I would also say that there are lots of queer people who have not felt safe or affirmed in the Castro. And so I'm hoping some of the work that we're doing with the cultural district may be able to change that. And maybe we can be part of building back better.
Now, the cultural district is specifically for the Castro was something that you authored a few years ago, 2018, 2019.
Yeah.
And it's part of a larger LGBTQ cultural heritage strategy.
There's an LGBTQ cultural heritage strategy that has been years in the making through the planning department, and that they've now kicked out a draft that we're going to have a hearing on. There's a range of ideas in there about how to preserve queer culture and heritage. It came out of legislation, I think, that Senator Wiener authored when he was on the Board of Supervisors. There's the idea of a drag laureate for San Francisco in there.
Yes, I heard. That sounds really interesting.
But there's also, been a lot of talk both, I think, in the cultural heritage strategy, but also in the economic recovery task force about how to preserve arts and culture, how to find the spaces where people can make and present arts and culture, and how to have housing that allows artists and people who create culture to be in San Francisco. One of the not great parts about pre-pandemic San Francisco was that so many people in the arts and culture community, but actually in small business, in lots of areas, were not able to afford to live in San Francisco. Something like, more than 50% of the people who were working in Castro small businesses before the pandemic were not living in San Francisco.
Right.
And that just seems unsustainable. So one of the silver linings of the pandemic is that rents are finally coming down. And I'm hoping that we'll see folks who may have left San Francisco or new folks who might be interested in coming to San Francisco finally able to afford San Francisco housing.
Are they coming down enough to make that happen? I mean, is part of the silver lining that hopefully that if rents come down, both commercial rents and residential rents, that a more diverse population can move into the Castro and other parts of the city?
I certainly hope so. And rents have come down significantly, but we'll see where it finally lands.
With so many restaurants and businesses closing, what do you think it will look and feel like after the worst of the pandemic passes?
Well, I am worried about the vacancies. We had a hearing on the vacancies in the Castro prior to the pandemic. There'd been a report that our office had requested about vacancies, and we'd actually pursued some legislation to make it easier to open certain kinds of businesses to get some of those storefronts filled up. I think we're going to have more vacancies unquestionably when we're out of this. But again, there is a silver lining. I think the exploration of the shared spaces program that's happened during the pandemic has been very interesting. I think the expansion of parklets and the use of parklets as a way for businesses to take over some of the right of way, and certainly restaurants have been able to use that. And I think it's added to the dynamism and the excitement, even in a really depressing time. And I'm actually working closely with the city departments and the mayor's office to look at ways to make some portion of this parklet expansion permanent and maybe a more permanent part of San Francisco street life.
Very good. Thank you. So two last questions I want to ask you before we have to close. Getting back to the LGBTQ cultural heritage strategy, as we talked about before, there's lots of initiatives in it, 50 proposals, I think something like that. Includes a freestanding LGBTQ museum, yeah. Affordable housing, as we talked about, financial support for queer-owned businesses. And according to an article in the BAR last August, the cost was going to be like 10 to 15 million for everything, and at least the top 10 steps, you know, between a million and 2 million. San Francisco is facing something like a $411 million budget shortfall next fiscal year. Is the price tag, is that going to make it difficult to fund any of the initiatives in the LGBTQ cultural heritage strategy?
Oh, certainly. But the fact that something is difficult doesn't mean it's not worth doing. I think the cost of some of those items is actually way more than the $15 million that maybe the BAR was attaching to it. I think, you know, we could easily spend $15 million or double or three times that on an LGBT history museum alone. And I think the cast, you know, the Historical Society does a great job with their space on 18th Street. I do believe that the Castro and the queer community deserve something bigger and more appropriate for the scale of the cultural change, cultural, political change that the Castro has played such a part in over the last 40 years. And so I have been and remain hopeful that some of these empty buildings can be converted into a really fantastic history museum, queer history museum. But you know, the agenda that is described in the heritage strategy is bold and broad, and it's not. You know, a guide that's not going to get done in a year or even two, but the ideas in there will probably should carry on, and we need to continue to work on them over the next, not years, but decades, really.
Briefly, can you tell us a little bit more about the Drag Laureate? What would the Drag Laureate do? And, you know, how serious is that proposal? I mean, it's silly.
Well,
but
I think it might have been West Hollywood. Someone's already stolen it from us and is moving forward with it.
Yeah, West Hollywood. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think it makes sense. Drag culture has been a big part of San Francisco nightlife, and you know, why not have a Drag Laureate? I guess it's not only in San Francisco thing, but maybe it's an only in San Francisco and West Hollywood thing now.
What would this person do?
I think spread the word and spread the gospel of drag. Promote it, perform, be the drag persona for San Francisco for a year.
And bring more tourists into the city, right?
And certainly bring more tourists. That would be, we will need that.
Very good. Is there anything else you want to bring up that we haven't covered?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we talked a little bit about the mental health and street challenges. And I think San Francisco needs to be bold in this regard. I think we need to try new approaches. I've introduced legislation to require that San Francisco actually have a place for every person who's unhoused on the street to go that is not the street. You know, I think we've invested a lot and moved, frankly, thousands and thousands of people into permanent supportive housing, and we need to continue to make those investments. But I think if we want to see an improvement in street conditions, we need to make a commitment in not having a situation in which people have to live on the street. And that may not mean we have a housing unit for everybody tomorrow. In fact, I think without a lot of help from Joe Biden, we're not going to be there. But I think we do need to say that a wealthy city like ours is going to make a commitment to not having people needing to find shelter in public, in those public spaces. Another thing I think we need to figure out in a way that we have not, but you know, no other city in California has or county, is how to finally deal with the needs of very sick people with mental illnesses who 40 or 50 years ago would have been in a mental institution and are not today. We don't want those people in jail. And increasingly, we're trying to keep people out of jail. And with some effectiveness, we've significantly reduced our jail population. But, you know, if we don't actually have good therapeutic places for people to be, and if we don't have policies that allow us to take folks off the streets who need help and may not even be able to accept help, I think we're going to fail in our goals. And I think right now, frankly, we are failing. We have closed the mental institutions. We are in the process of closing jails and prisons. We have not figured out the places for people who are going to have a lot of needs, and some of whom are going to need a lot of help and direction, folks like my mother, and folks with illnesses far more serious than my mother's. The notion that those folks are just somehow going to figure it out is the height of irresponsibility. And I think San Francisco is uniquely positioned to make some of the mental health investments, do some of the work around conservatorship, which I've been a champion for, and actually try to take care of people who need that help. If we're going to try to treat these things through the public health lens rather than the criminal justice lens or the mass institutionalization approach, it's going to take a lot of resources and a lot of attention, and I'm trying to give it some of that attention.
This seems like an issue that is, you know, even for a city of the stature and size of San Francisco, it's more than any one city can do. And you mentioned the Biden-Harris administration. Do you actually have hopes for expecting something substantial from the new federal administration or from the state administration?
I mean, I have some hope in that their policies have already changed. You know, the policies of the federal government in the few weeks that that Biden has been president, Kamala Harris has been vice president, their FEMA reimbursement policies have changed to make it easier for counties to have unhoused people sheltering in hotels. That's a little change. It doesn't solve the problem kind of in a long-term way. And of course, it's going to take Congress going along. But if the federal government really were to invest in housing for very poor people in ways it has not done since 1980, that would make a big difference in our homelessness problems. If the federal and state government were to really invest in community-based treatment, in case management, and in alternatives to incarceration and into institutionalization in a way that they never have, that also, I think, would radically transform people's experiences of cities like San Francisco right now.
Okay, very good. You've been listening to Out in the Bay. My guest this half hour has been San Francisco City and County Supervisor Rafael Mandelman, who represents District 8, which includes the Castro. Thank you so much for joining us here.
Thank you, Eric.
To learn more about the supervisor and his work, check out our website, outinthebay.org, where we will post links. That's outinthebay.org. You can also hear this show there again and past shows and share them with friends. Please also sign up for our weekly email newsletter. Growing our numbers will help us secure funding. And you can also subscribe to Out in the Bay via Stitcher and Apple Podcasts. You could also make a donation to help us keep bringing queer air to your ears. Just hit the donate tab on our website, outinthebay.org. That's outinthebay.org. Also, we'd love your comments. Email us at outinthebaysf@gmail.com. How are we doing? What do you want to hear? You can also send an email there if you'd like to join our team. We're looking for various positions. We have them available. You can see the post on our website under this week's post. That's outinthebay.org. Or just email us. Again, the email address is outinthebaysf@gmail.com. Our theme music was written by Holly Mead. Thanks to Holly. And thanks to my producer for this episode, Kendra Klang. I'm Eric Jansen. Thanks for joining us out in the Bay.